You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Well done for making it here. And we're so thrilled that we're kicking off our programme at long last with such a wonderful session, Queer Genealogy, all about the history of LGBTQ plus inclusion at Greenbelt. And I'm going to hand over to this wonderful panel on this very small stage. We thank you for squishing on. Very grateful to you for squishing onto our little stage. I'm going to hand over to Padraig, I think.
Oh, you can't hear us at the back. We'll try to make sure. Can you hear us a bit better now? You can now. Okay, we'll try to make sure to keep the volume up. Hello, you're all very welcome to the Hope and Anchor, which has been re-anchored after having been unanchored. Hopefully that's the only unanchored time. I think that lots of people, when they come to Greenbelt, they get a little bit gayer. Lots of people put on fairy wings or a little bit of frill or something like that. I've always found that a thoroughly enjoyable part of Greenbelt. And so we are going to talk a little bit about that tonight. We're going to celebrate and mark and honour the history of the kind of inclusion as it's grown at Greenbelt. Change affects us all, and it can affect us in different ways. And so we really want to make sure that all of you who come tonight, especially those of us who've had to bear the changes about changing faith spaces and their inclusion, it could be that when you hear something, that memories come up where you think, oh, I'd really like to talk to somebody about that, or that's affecting me now more than I thought it would. So we just want to make sure, before we say anything, just to remind you that there's entire groups of people here to support your well-being. They've got well-being on their shirt. There's the Out Greenbelt stall. That's just back on that way, back over towards the Festival Village. If you find yourself going, I wouldn't mind a bit of a chat like that with somebody, you're not alone. If you're thinking, I heard something there that just reminded me of what it was like when I was in a church, you'll meet people and we'd be very happy to provide support and conversation for you to listen to that. So I want to make sure that you know that. With that said, we've got people here tonight from different eras of the Greenbelt approach to what was sometimes called the gay issue. And we're going to talk about the gay issue, which is very exciting. I don't know what the gay issue is. He does. We're going to talk about the evolution of it from it being a conversation to be discussed like that into fully integrated out at Greenbelt along the way. So I'm going to pass the microphone around. People can introduce themselves. My name is Padraig. I've been coming to Greenbelt for about 22 or 23 years. And it's been a very important part for me in coming out, in thinking through questions to do with religion, in thinking through questions to do with public safety and owning my own story. So Greenbelt's been very important for me in that. Pass it over.
Terrific. Why don't you guys take it away? But just introduce yourself and say who you are.
Hiya, my name is Chris, pronouns he, him. I am a midwife by trade and Anglican by background, and I am currently part of the Out team and have been coming to Greenbelt and volunteering with Out since 2019.
Hi everyone, my name's Hayley, pronouns are she, her. I've been coming to Greenbelt since 2016, so in terms of eras, which we'll probably get into in a bit. I saw the end of the Outer Space area, and then as soon as Outer Greenbelt appeared, I started volunteering with them. Yes, so I've seen a little bit of change, but not as much as these guys.
I'm thinking, sorry. Speaking
to the mic. Into the mic, like this. My name's Robert Palmer. In the late 80s and early 90s, I was in charge of the theatre here, and the theatre programme. And then after a time, I moved off from Greenbelt, and now I work as a psychotherapist, and I specialise in gender, sexuality, sex and relationships.
And when was the last time you came to Greenbelt?
I haven't been to Greenbelt since 1991. I know. This is so strange. It really is.
I'm Willie Williams. I was a compere during the 80s. My first Greenbelt was in 1976, which is weird because it's before I was born. Greenbelt was a huge, huge part of my life. And say through the 80s, compere the main stage. And then it got a little bit complicated. due to what we're going to talk about, really, I think. Where should we start at the beginning, I suppose?
Yes. Do you want to start at your beginning?
No, let's start with your beginning.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the 80s, let's just begin by saying Greenbelt was a wonderful place to be, as it is today. And indeed, I don't know whether you realize, but some of the people who were, well, even the chair of Greenbelt is here from the 1980s. So you've got some people who've been around for a very, very long time. We're really touched that they've come to see us today. And I really enjoyed doing the theater. I was out and gay. But I think at the time, as far as I remember, I was probably one of the only people in the Greenbelt, on the committees, running the programs, who was out. And you were here, but you were most definitely not out, if I remember rightly. You were very in. And you weren't going to come out at that time. And what I did was subtly bring in a few queer shows in my time, talking about being Christian, being gay, but also as we move into the 90s as well and into the late 80s, you've also got the AIDS crisis as well. And we did a show called AIDS Show at that time, which was a very important piece of work. But there were other issues going on with Greenbelt at the same time. And although everybody was very supportive, the theology underneath was really quite different to the way that we felt about our own sexuality. And indeed, there was a book, wasn't there, called Dark Glasses, which was written by a number of Greenbelt directors and friends of Greenbelt, which indeed you have a copy of.
Indeed. Yes, it's an interesting read. But again, a little bit of context about the 80s anyway. There was
Margaret Thatcher
and Section 28, so we could not have the promotion.
And the age of same-sex consent was 21 years old. Those were the days. And part of the reason I had a circuitous journey was I really trusted Greenbelt. And, you know, I do have a tendency to over-intellectualize things. But just as an example of kind of what was in the air, there's just a couple of texts, blah, blah, blah. Some Christians have claimed the Bible does not forbid homosexual practice as such, but just homosexual practice that is not for life with one partner. It's obviously important we discover which view is right. For your own study, the key biblical texts are. And then there are those seven biblical texts, which we've all beaten ourselves to death with over the years. Having carefully read these texts again and studied the arguments of those who wish to argue against traditional interpretation, but also have a genuine commitment to be ruled by Scripture, I still cannot see that there is any biblical warrant for any form of homosexual practice. So that was a tough one, and that was the same guy. The slightly more unhinged one was... Where are you? Oh yeah, this is about the... Because I hope some of you are too young to remember the ex-gay movement, where being gay was treated like a disease that could be cured. The hostility of Christian and non-Christian gay groups to the message that change is possible for the homosexual may arise from the threat to their views of sex, morality, and God. We can only face the painful reality that our own choices have blocked our change when we have the discipline to overcome that pain by being totally dedicated to the truth, etc., etc. So it was a tough environment to grow up in, and you can only... And kind of that's where Robert left off. And on site today, the first thing Robert saw...
Yes.
Was Flamey Grant on the main stage? So how did that make you feel?
Do you know that you come into this festival, and after 30-something years, there is a certain anxiety about it. Still, you're still left where you left, if you see what I mean. And so you walk in and see Flamey Grant on the stage, and you think, what on earth has happened? What have you done? But what you have done, by the look of things, is something absolutely amazing, which the change that's taken place in this festival seems to be very deep and very, very exciting.
Cool. Yeah, there you go. So, So in the face of all that, you know, and I was coming out and all of this, and I just got so tired of the fact that, you know, Greenbelt had never been afraid to look at big issues, you know, the hothouse, all that kind of thing. And the problem with the book, I think, is that it's one thing to have a discussion, something that's live, and you have different voices. When it's written down, it becomes a polemic and lasts forever. And it's still available on Amazon, by the way. Yes, still available. You can still buy it. £3.45. Yeah.
Dark Glasses.
Dark Glasses is the name of the book. Anyway, in the face of all that, it was the fact that it wasn't that gay things weren't being talked about. It was always gay followed by the word issue. And so there'd be discussions, or there'd be this, that, and the other. And Robert and I got to a point where we thought, wouldn't it be great if there was just a place where we could just kind of meet?
So as I ran the theatre, I also was very lucky and was also programming something called the Theatre Cafe, which had the fine art in it. But it also meant it was quite quiet in the evenings. So what we did was create a space called No Agenda, which was a space for queer people to come along and meet. But the thing is, we didn't tell Greenbelt, the committees, that we, but it was in the program, quietly slipped in.
It wasn't in the program.
Was it not in the program? How did we do it?
Flyers and things.
Oh, that's right. And so...
Codes.
Flags.
Skywriting.
And we started very slowly but very surely. And in that first night, there was about 8 people. And by the third or the fourth night, there was about 40 people.
Including 2 women.
Yes. And that was the very first time queer people had met together in a venue in Greenbelt. And that was incredibly exciting for us.
And then we ran screen.
And then we left.
So then what happened?
Yes.
Then there's a massive gap in 2 hour space in terms of my knowledge. No, so I'm aware that, over the years, different groups developed and took on what you guys started. Until mostly what I can speak on is Outer Space. So when I started coming in 2016, something, an important part of my story is that I was gay first and Christian as an adult. Faith came later. So when I discovered Greenbelt and I knew people coming, I was like, really? I know you're telling me this is a safe space, but my experience as a gay person first and what someone growing up Christian and a gay person might think is a safe space might be very different things. So I remember walking into the campsite and seeing all these rainbow flags and being like, well, it's just Pride. What did you, why didn't you tell me it was Pride? And then discovering all Outer Space at that point was still programming events themselves and going to Outer Space Eucharist and discovering all these queer Christians was just so overwhelming. But by then, yeah, it was a very well established within the program. There were always talks, but they were still within the takeaway. They were still fringe. They did all the legwork and all of that. And then over the next few years, Greenbelt went on this journey and said, well, why aren't you just one of our core teams? You're there, yeah. Why not? Yeah. And in 2019, I got an email asking me if I'd like to volunteer with the new Outer Greenbelt, and it was a very easy yes. I had no idea what to expect at that point or what that would mean in reality. What that looks like now is that Greenbelt run all the queer programming, and we look after. Well, we still put on some programming ourselves, but we look after the social side and making sure that LGBT people have a space to meet and get together. And be themselves and come and talk to us on the stall, and we still do the Eucharist, but all those education pieces we don't have to do so much and put the energy into that because Greenbelt wants to do that themselves.
As I said, I first turned up in 2019. I was asked by Tracy who is our team leader, to come and volunteer at this festival, and my first impression when I turned up, it was absolutely amazing to be in a space where actually I'm queer and I'm Christian, and at worst, no one gives a damn. And at best, it's celebrated. And the things that I've seen over the past few years is there's more and more queer artists who are being brought forward and celebrated. And something we were saying in our discussions earlier, that they weren't just put on the program to discuss the gay issue. They were there, they were gay, but this, look at the wonderful things that they do and produce, and the knowledge and wisdom and everything that they can bring to enrich the festival and everyone present. And they just happen to be queer, which is a beautiful thing to me.
I'm kind of interested in where you are, because I think for me, there was an incredibly difficult period of time, a very troublesome period of time, of not being able to reconcile sexuality with spirituality. And there was this incredible split that I experienced, which in therapy we call, well, it called it a split, I guess, but it's a break within the person, where you are unable to be authentic, where you are unable to self-actualize, where actually you're living two different kinds of lives, where the sexual, and well, actually the sexual combines everything, you know, it's not just the body, it's the mind, it's the political, it's the social, and the spiritual was on the other side. And it was a very painful place to be. And I kind of wanted to know, do you experience these splits? Or?
Yes, but not at Greenbelt. That experience, that split is at home, because at home I'm in a very rural area. So if I go to church, I'm fairly lucky that, you know, my vicar is lovely and inclusive, but the congregation generally are a bit... And the queer community I'm part of, I'm the only one that's going to church. So I have that divide there. So while I am always opening myself and I won't hide who I am, I don't get to be, it's very hard to be all of that when there's no one else around you supporting that. So to get to, yeah, the only place I get to do that regularly, know it's going to happen, is Greenbelt.
And similarly, as someone is queer, whenever you come into a faith space especially, but generally in life, you're always on the lookout for the signs that, is this somewhere that is safe for me? The places that say they're inclusive and then have run an alpha course or whatever sign it is for you, that this place might not necessarily be safe. Whereas coming here, there isn't that split. You are celebrated as being a whole person. Both all those aspects of yourself are together and celebrated. And in fact, that has led out from here into my wider life. I found that just accepting that that those two can be together and don't have to be used as a battering ram against me, and actually embracing that, celebrating that, and be unapologetically queer and Christian outside of Greenbelt.
I find that really unapologetically. And I think in our time, there was a sense of apology. And that was quite difficult. It's, you know, conversion therapy is still available now, which I find very interesting. And I know that, you know, there's been a law which is not yet to be passed around banning conversion therapy. In our day, it was a very, very powerful force.
Mm. Yeah, totally.
Were you ever involved in?
We had a look.
Did you?
Had a look. Hmm? Were you? Do tell.
Well, I think I was involved in conversion therapy, not at Greenbelt, let it be really clear. My experience of Greenbelt was coming in 2003 coming to a place where it was pretty clear that the general vibe was towards inclusion. And the question was, is how to mainstream that? And I think that took the leadership of people like Dave and Alex and Tracy and Paul Northup and people who just began to go, let's just make this more and more and more. And people, queer people and allies who just began to mainstream and speak in public, and program speakers who were out and speaking about their lives or speaking about linguistics or interviewing people about literature. And over the years of that, the queer Eucharist that we had went from being in a room where the windows were blacked out. And that wasn't so that other people couldn't see. It was often so that people like me, who were in a work situation where I could have been fired if I was out, it was more for my protection rather than Greenbelt to be protected. Greenbelt was providing a safe space because the wider society wasn't that safe. And my first queer Eucharist, I was petrified to be seen to be going in and delighted that it was being offered. And so I credit Greenbelt with kind of meeting me where my safety needs were at. And that was in 2003. And over the years, it was slowly more mainstreamed and more made easier. And I changed my circumstances too, so I felt much easier. But during that time, there was once a group. They don't come anymore, but they used to come to advertise here about come and do our faith development courses. And they were the people through whom I had done some I'd been put through some reparative therapy and exorcisms, which is very exciting and completely ineffectual. I have as many gay devils now as I did then. I've got more, actually. And it was troubling to me. And I remember writing to Greenbelt afterwards to say, it's complicated for me to see a Christian organization who quietly, they didn't have the guts to say it in public, but quietly believe that gay people can be cured or exorcised, being here trying to run funky events kind of at a fringe space. And I got a great reception from the leadership of Greenbelt to say, thank you for alerting us to this. And we take this very seriously. And we are going to start to make inquiries from now on. And that group didn't come back. So I was. It was really nice because it was less about me being protected and more about thinking I didn't want other people to be made vulnerable to manipulation from that point of view. And so I have found Greenbelt to be a place that has always been ahead of the curve. I'd like that the entire society of Ireland and the UK had been a lot better. But Greenbelt was usually a touch better than the way things were in public. And I think as years have gone on, it's been more than a touch better. It's been increasingly and increasingly and increasingly safe. And that has been happening over 20 years of leadership and courage and allyship, as well as leadership from queer people, which has been extraordinarily moving. And I think it has shown it isn't just to make things safe for queer people. What I've seen is that the heterosexuals too feel happier when the entire thing is a lot more inclusive, that it demonstrates a way of being human, of honouring our sexuality and honouring the diversity of our lives that isn't just only about inclusion. Of course, there's a lot more that society has to do, but I'm moved at how much a space of learning and change Greenbelt has been. And that's come with risks. I think there's been sponsors that have dropped out and money that's been lost and, you know, various accusations made. But I've felt like the courage of Greenbelt leadership has just continued to magnify throughout the years to say, yeah, that's okay. That's what we're willing to do and willing to take. And that's often been led by people like Tracy, people like Dave and Alex, people like Paul Northup as well, who've just been willing to go, yeah, we'll take it on the chin. And it's been magnificent to be part of that and to see it happen.
Yeah. I completely concur. And even the reason I read those things really was just more to set the tone of the nation, because, you know, Greenbelt, the spirit of Greenbelt has always been to try and do the right thing and try and be there for as many people as possible. And all I could say about that period was you should have seen what the other festivals were doing. So it's not, in that sense, it's not a criticism. It was more to sort of set the scene. But of course, you know, you don't always get things right first time. And the fact that queer people are running the queer programming, a really good idea. No, it's great. And again, seeing it through Robert's eyes is fantastic, because it's a real reminder of just how far the festival's come. So.
Yeah, it's lovely to be here, but there is still kind of a sense of anger, maybe a gentle anger. It's not my anger.
Do you want to talk about your anger?
I think I will. You know, having
do you want
been
talk about it a bit closer into the mic.
Yeah, having been in a situation, I'll be angry closer to the mic. having lost a youth, having lost teenage years of delayed sexuality, delayed development, because I could not be myself, where you would see young men and women getting together, kissing behind the bike sheds, maybe having some sex, certainly dating. I was never allowed this. I never had this experience. You know, mine was something that could never be spoken about, never could be discussed. And it was very, very secret. And holding these things down, I think, when you are very young, is a very dangerous thing to do. And when we think about the people who are meant to be looking after our spiritual beings, mostly straight male pastors or vicars or whoever, clergy, whoever they are, that actually that they have some hold over my body, my sexuality, my being, I think was a very, very difficult thing to have experienced. And I'm sure there are others here who feel exactly the same. And thank you. And, you know, I see it in the therapy room now with people who have become so entangled with some kind of conversion therapy over the years, who even now, when they try and have sex with somebody of the same sex, will have such guilt and such shame, who cannot form healthy relationships, that we see how deep this runs and how painful it is for everybody. That really we need to call this out and make sure this does not happen anymore.
On the stall, we get so many people coming to talk to us, which is amazing. And unfortunately, we do still hear that that is happening. It's far less than it was, but we still do get people coming to us telling us that they can't be out at home. They've got no one to talk to, but they get to come to Greenbelt. And that's why I think out at Greenbelt being such a visible presence and a part of the core Greenbelt ethos is so important, because it's at one place that they can go, that those two parts of them can be fully married up and go, it is okay, it will get better. And the people around you telling you that it's not okay are very wrong.
Thank you. I just think, because being a slightly little younger than Robert and I, whether that was part of your experience or had the world evolved sufficiently?
You're a few years younger than me, but I was born the year before Section 28 was implemented, so I grew up with that fully implemented, and it was repealed the year I took my GCSEs. So my access to queer education as a young person was did not exist. But then the internet existed, and that was probably not an entirely safe way for young people to access it. So if you don't teach people, they will go out and find it themselves. So that was my experience.
And says I'm not that much younger than you, so it's not that dissimilar. But yeah, growing up, I'd had all of those messages internalized for many years through my upbringing. I was brought up in Buckinghamshire in a very white middle class environment, and all of those cis-het patriarchal messages were very, very internalized to the point where I didn't even let myself acknowledge that I was queer until I was 25, so not that long ago, really.
And do you think it's worse in the world outside? Because you were blessed to grow up without a Christian upbringing. And is it the same in the world outside, or is it much the same inside?
So my experience of growing up in a not Christian background was my parents were like, why are you scared to tell us? Because I didn't tell them. They came to me and went, Hayley, is there something you'd like to tell us? And I went, no. And I knew exactly what they meant. I was like, no. I burst into tears, and Dad was like, how about the fact that you're gay? And I went, oh, that is like, yeah, all right. We don't keep secrets in this whole household. Tell your sisters. And that was it. When they found out I started going to church, they were like a lot more confused. That they didn't understand.
I love the 21st century. It's great, and it's so much better than that other one. But I discovered fairly recently that Robert's evangelical upbringing was entirely self-inflicted.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, no, I actually was searching it out. I mean, my parents were very strange. We were all vegans. In the 70s.
Back before it was cool.
And we had, they were very involved with the transcendental movement. I think my mother was in love with the Beatle. And so we were all inducted into transcendental meditation, but it didn't do it for me. I was looking for family because I didn't really connect very well with my own birth family. So the church provided a very good place to do that. But it came with a huge problem. So I went through the C of E, I went into the evangelical movement, and then ended up in Greenbelt. And you were with the Brethren, weren't you?
No, the Brethren was self-inflicted. I did the classic C of E upbringing, but similar, it's funny you say that, because similarly I was in one sense looking for family, because my biological family was a bit of a train wreck. And in moving down to London, on the advice of my crusader leader from Sheffield, went to a Brethren chapel in Golders Green. And the person who'd recommended it was Scottish, so I thought this was some kind of Scottish sect. I was getting confused with Gretna Green as opposed to Golders Green, because Yorkshire was a long way from London in the 70s. And of course, the classic line is, the definition of a Brethren chapel is this shack parked in the woods with 12 BMWs parked outside of it. But I met some great people, one of whom I married. For a period of time. But no, Greenbelt was my family. Because of my first Greenbelt, it was obviously before I was born, if it was 1974. But no, I was 15, 16 maybe, and found my way here by myself. And this immediately became my family, and still is really, in terms of, you know, the huge number of the people, the most important people in my life, I know through Greenbelt, including you.
But we knew of each other.
Yeah.
But we didn't talk to each other. And you were married at the time.
Still am, in God's eyes. And we were very suspicious of each other. Because it's funny, we were chatting. I wouldn't say we'd planned anything for the seminar, but that would be a stretch. And I was saying, the thing is, growing up and all of that, I just, you know, these things are so important, but I just couldn't talk about it. To which Robert replied, I couldn't not talk about it, as we remember. So we're super suspicious of each other. Anyway, long story short, we both ended, I'm not making this up, at a friend's birthday party, we discovered that in a few days' time, we were both flying to Montreal to work with different dance companies in Montreal. Talk about niche.
But we'd been booked.
And we were on the same flight. So we met at Gatwick and sat next to each other, and on the whatever 8-hour journey, just told our stories, and, you know, been bezzy mates forever. So, although we still don't really agree on anything, but
and I took you to your very, very first gay bar.
Pretty much, yeah. And we're digressing, but that's not untrue. But and I thought, right, it's great, and go with Robert. Robert's like the bar, because Montreal has this massive gay area. It's called the Gay Village. It's about the size of Greenbelt. And it's just anything you want. And so we go into this bar, and think it's brilliant. And with Robert, he'll just like know the ropes and this, that, and the other. So we're there, and we get a drink, and we're looking around at all this kind of thing. Oh, it's very interesting. And then it was busy Saturday night, Montreal. And eventually Robert says, would you mind going and see if it's okay to go to the loo?
I was terribly shy.
First gay bar, come on.
Yes.
First gay bar, wow. I was 18, would have been Bath. I lived not far from Bath, and we got the train, me and my best mate Adam, and went to this tiny little place called the Bath Tap that was run by two lesbians, and sat in the corner and had a drink. And then there was this massive fight between one of the bar manager's ex-girlfriends or something, and there was a whole, yeah, it was an experience. And then didn't go for a while, and then started going out, yeah, Bristol and Birmingham.
I tended not to engage in going to many bars in general, much more of an old man wanting to go to a nice ale pub. So the concept of going to a gay bar with lots and lots of loud camp music, which nowadays is much more fun. Shout out to everyone that's involved in Glitterball later. But yes, my first experience was probably in Propaganda in Nottingham, which it's gone now, unfortunately, because it was one of the few queer spaces left that was dedicated to queer in Nottingham. But yeah, it's absolute dive. but the only thing going for it was that it was gay. But yeah.
This would be good, Northern
Ireland. I actually had a great time. My first gay bar was in Dublin. I went on a Sunday afternoon, very mild time, and two friends of mine were going, and I, at that stage, was, I told some people I was gay. I was 23, but I was very frightened and would have been fired. And I said to one of my friends, "What's the point in going?" And he said, "You might figure it out once you're in there." And we sat inside this bar and had a pint. That was it. Just sat for 45 minutes. And I looked around and I thought, is everyone here like me? And it was the first time, I think, that I thought, oh, my God. Because I'd been so pathologized through exorcisms and reparative therapy. And I knew those things were wrong, but I still was very much under the thumb of such terrible thinking. And it was so healing to sit there. And it was people chatting. There was a fella sitting by himself. And one of my friends said to the fella, "Do you want to come over and join us?" It was kind of like being here, you know, just people thinking, there's probably a lot of people in this room are filled with isolation. They've come in, and why not say to people, come and join us? And people made friends and found out who was a mutual friend and, you know, all of the kinds of stuff. And then resumed anonymity when you went out because you don't know what the wide world is. But that experience on out in the Liffey in Dublin was just brilliant. I've worked in conflict resolution for a long time, and there's a theory in conflict resolution that once you arrive at a peace treaty, peace hasn't begun. That's just the beginning of peace, and that it takes as long for peace to arrive as it took for the peace treaty to arrive. So, like, therefore, when you think of things like inclusion of LGBTQ people, and lots of people will say, well, look, for God's sake, you're on Coronation Street now, even on the Archers, like you're absolutely in. So it's fine. It's all achieved. And what I think we have to remind ourselves is to go, in many ways, we are still in the early days of inclusion, in the early days of normalization. And there's only a very few amount of people have grown up within the context of it being absolutely fine in the context of your family to say, I've got a crush on this person, a crush on that person, and everybody's like, oh, great. And there's trauma within that. And I don't wish to make it worse than it is, but I do think there's lots of us inside here who we might kind of connect with the anger to go, I do feel like there was a lot of my childhood was taken, or a lot of the freedom to be able to just talk openly the way my mates did. And again, to remind people of the services that out at Greenbelt provide, as well as the well-being people, and in your own environment too, to seek out people who help you create that world of normality, while others of us, when we have the energy, try to make that on a wider societal level too, to try to increase the length of time within which people know it's absolutely safe to be queer, because that is such a new concept, and there are so many people who still, for whom still it's new. And there are so many people who have decades of pain before we got there. And I think that's an important thing for us to recognise.
Those young people that... Sorry, Gwen, one second. Those young people that we do get through now that aren't experiencing the same trauma that we have are amazing. And it's so overwhelming. They come through and they're out in their teens and there's no shame, there's no trauma. They might have different trauma and we've got to learn how to support them is out at Greenbelt with what they need rather than what we've needed in the past. But they're incredible. And every time they come and talk to us, we're just also overwhelmed by how incredible these young people are.
I want to bring in another trauma. This is going to bring everything down a little bit. But one thing we've not talked about is HIV and AIDS. Because for our time...
That was a laugh.
That was a horrible, horrible time. And it was 1983 was the first case. So by the time we kind of got to Greenbelt, I think it was about 1986, 1987, the AIDS epidemic was in full flood, really. And thousands, if you don't know, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of gay men died in the UK and many, many, many millions across the world. And of course, that affected our ability to be able to have sex and to be able to have relationships because, first of all, you never knew at that time, because there was no treatment, what infected you. could you kiss this person? Could you have sex with this person? Would it be okay? Is this going to be the contact that kills you? And that kind of, it's really deep within you in those days, I think. And you must have had the same kind of experience as well.
Yeah, well, kind of, sort of. I mean, because again, because I arrived late to the party. Yeah. I mean, COVID was really interesting. Because if you imagine COVID, what we've all just been through, except if you got COVID, A, you would definitely die. And B, everybody would vilify you because it was your fault. But otherwise, it was pretty much the same as COVID. But my big, I was just thinking that was actually brilliant, Padraig, what you were saying. And my big deprogramming was I moved to San Francisco. And I spent 8 years in San Francisco, which I have to say was absolutely fantastic. It was San Francisco in the 90s. It was the Bill Clinton years. And Britain was in the middle of all of that stuff. And honestly, I was over the rainbow. It was amazing. But I'll tell you what was really amazing. Because you think of San Francisco, especially back then, you know, Tales of the City and all that. And you think, oh, it's this super gay city. Gay, everything will be gay. Of course, you get there and it kind of looks like anywhere else. But I used to say, in my experience, being gay in San Francisco is like being white at Greenbelt, where if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time and something really bizarre happened, you know, maybe it might be an issue or someone might mention it. But generally speaking, you just don't think about it. And the line is, you know you're in San Francisco because when your hairdresser's straight and your plumber's gay. And it's just a society that's so over it that you just get on and think about other things. You know, I didn't actually think about being gay, because we were gay then rather than queer, which we should probably touch on. But anyway, yeah. But the other side of that coin was I moved there in about 94. 93, I started going a lot, then 94. So it was absolutely in the teeth of the AIDS epidemic. And it's a weird thing to say, because like COVID, where you sort of got used to the fact that you wore a mask everywhere or you just sanitized your hands or whatever was going on, honestly, you just got used to the fact. My little cafe I used to go to, you know, there'd be people in there on wheeling drips in, and you just got used to seeing the walking dead, basically, on the street. And it didn't make it any better, but it was almost as shocking how much that community, that gentle community, could adapt to this Holocaust, basically. But the huge favor it did me was, it was speed deprogramming. I mean, I literally come back going, did you remind me what the problem was again? The gay issue. Can you remind me what that was? I've forgotten. But at the same time, it was obviously deeply traumatizing to be there for all that.
My first job was on an HIV ward. And my job was to diagnose people. And this was in Newham General, which is in East London. It had quite an interesting population of HIV patients, because there are a lot of African women there, because there'd been wars in Somalia, there'd been wars in Congo. And these were women who'd come over with their children and had come onto the wards, and they had been multiply raped by armies and then found out that they were positive. Their children were positive and they died. And they and the gay men were all together on this ward, and the connection they made was absolutely beautiful to watch. But the sadness, I used to go onto the ward and the doctors and the nurses would scatter because the Grim Reaper had arrived. And you know, I don't know if you've seen any films on HIV, and it's always everybody's in kind of separate rooms and they're looked after. It wasn't like that. It was like a war zone. In Newham General, everybody was in beds next to each other. He would just go around giving the diagnosis, and you would know within a month or so, everybody would be dead. How do you live in a world where you don't have any of this?
What, how do you feel about it? Is it like hearing people talk about the war, or is it?
Yeah, a little bit.
We're so old.
I think, again, Section 28 comes into this, that it wasn't mentioned at school. The only time gay people were mentioned in my entire school career was in sex ed, and it was, you know, gay people get AIDS. And that was the one mention. So it wasn't until I was in my late teens and out and in the queer community that you get to start learning your own history. I've now helped set up my own town's local pride, and I run a local LGBT book club. And part of that is we make an effort to read books on queer history and from different the different letters in LGBT and people's different experiences, because it wasn't given to us and we had to go find it ourselves. So yeah, it is. Well, at least with the war, I'm taught about that. I have to go find this myself. Yeah. And finding people to tell us about it, because so many died, is quite hard. So, yeah, when I do get to hear about it, it's incredible and emotional. And I wish I'd been able to learn about it earlier.
Yeah, similarly, growing up as a kid, it's like, yeah, gay people get AIDS and die. That's... Even back in the 90s, that was all you heard about it. And the transition that we've had now to it being, okay, HIV is a thing, it's not a death sentence, we have PrEP, we have PEP, and we have all these treatments, and it's still an issue, but it's nowhere near as far and wide-reaching as it was. Yeah. Yeah, it's not a death sentence.
Podrick sends his apologies. He's got another gig. Should we do some questions?
Yes.
Anybody remotely interested in what we're saying? Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
So the question, if people at the back didn't hear, was, have we gone too pink? Have we gone too far? And I think there's an element to which potentially, yes, there should be a point to it, actually. I said, it shouldn't be remarkable that we're here, we're queer, we're wonderful, we're part of this, same as everywhere else. But the fact that looking at outside of Greenbelt, everything is falling to shit for so many of our community, just looking at the way that the trans community is being absolutely vilified, and hated and attacked on every single side. And then we as a space are supposed to be looking at how we can change that. And whilst I agree that it shouldn't be the issue, like being queer in general shouldn't be the issue, I think it's being quite so visible allows us to not just fade into the background and helps rally us to fight what needs to be fought, because although we've come a really, really long way, like all of the horror stories that we've heard, like there's still a long way to go, because we are nowhere near equality, we are nowhere near justice. So actually being a massive pink thorn in the side, I think is a good thing personally. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's a really good point. You know, it's a really good point. But, you know, queer people keeping quiet, can't see it happening anytime soon, really. Just, you know, as a friend, as a non-queer friend. So, anybody who...
You said about people today, they have their teeth, or black out, and proud and have community in school. That kind of described my entire experience exactly. My question is,
hell yeah.
Yes.
Do you know something? When I was in the sixth form at school, we had year 14. Yeah, I don't know. What sixth form?
Let's repeat the question.
It was about, do I wish that we had grown up in the same way that you do now, I think is to summarise it, isn't it? And I don't know what year sixth form is, but it's when you're 17.
We still call it sixth form, but yeah.
That's nice to know. And some things never change. And we were...
After year 12, you go to sixth form.
No, after year 11, you go to sixth form.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
Oh, come on, Grandpa. Well,
anyway, sorry.
Anyway. So, and we used to go, and we were allowed to read magazines at lunchtime in the library. And there used to be a magazine in London called Time Out. I don't know whether that, I don't think it exists anymore. And in the back, online, and in the back, it used to have a queer section, or it was called a gay section in those days, and it used to have dating things at the back. And our school would cut out the gay section so that we couldn't look at it. So that's how kind of deeply entrenched it was in school. So, yes, absolutely, I wish that I had been through the experience that you're having. And I think what's happening for you is absolutely wonderful. I wouldn't wish what we experienced on anybody at all.
There's, in my age, there's a term we call that when quite a few of us get to 16 and 18 and start figuring this out, we have gay panic and fail our A-levels because you're so terrified and so busy thinking about this big thing that all everything else goes to crap. And I know so many that that yeah went from doing really well at GCSE to failing at A-level.
I'm actually going to say the other way of no, I wouldn't. I am so thankful that we live at a point where you have the experience that you're having. But, and it sucks that we had to fight these battles, but from a personal point of view, those battles have equipped me for what's going ahead, and it makes me who I am. I have scars, and each of them talks of a time where I survived, and I'd rather have that and be able to use that to help other people. So, yeah.
So the question is, how does a church encourage queer people to feel safe and become part of the community without coming across, I forget what you said, but it was great, as just like trying too hard? I'm totally unqualified to answer this question.
From my point of view, for anyone that's come to faith, it's rarely because of the building you went into, it's the people and the relationships. That's personally how I came to faith, and everyone who is involved in that within your church needs to be people who queer people feel safe to encounter Christ with. And so from in terms of practical help, I'm sorry, that's not great. And in fact, that is one of the things that I wanted to ask everyone. Coming out of this, we've talked about the past and we've talked about the future of Greenbelt, and from the outside of things, we are looking to the future and what do you want from us, both the queer folk and those of us wanting to engage the queer folk, of what do you want from us and what do we need to support everyone going forward.
If I can put my thought in. When I was choosing a church, I literally deep stalked every church in my local town to figure out if it was vaguely safe for me to go to. What was my deciding factor was finding the vicar followed someone that I knew from Greenbelt. And I was like, oh, that sounds like maybe they could be an okay person then. And that was how limited information I had. So honestly, anything visibly you can do, because we will go searching that deep if we're trying to find a safe space.
It's a bit early for Robert to comment, I think, but although he's been flourishing a lot today, I think.
To reiterate, what brings us queer joy at Greenbelt? What's our favourite stuff? What leads to us flourishing that is provided here?
What brings you queer joy?
Again, for me, I'm going to say people. The relationships that I have formed here, the many... many late nights with this wonderful person beside me out in the arms of Jesus until 2 in the morning drinking a ridiculous amount of crazy goat and the conversations and the fellowship. And again, a place that is just safe.
So at my church, I can rock up to service on the Sunday morning after having been to Pride on the Saturday, still covered in stickers and slightly hungover. And my vicar will be like, have you had a good time, Hayley? He knows exactly where I've been and what I've been doing the day before. And he just like everyone else, he asks how's my weekend going and wants to know. The rest of the congregation basically ignore me when I show up like that, apart from one or two of them. When my ex broke up with me, he bought me flowers and acknowledged my heartbreak and that's, you know, so it just being treated the way he treats every other parishioner.
Weird joy?
No, I was just thinking you never bought me flowers. Oh. So, you know, I'm just pleased to be here.
You never broke that.
I'm pleased to be alive. And I'm pleased after 34 years to have been invited back here again. And I really do appreciate that. And I appreciate seeing people that I've not seen in 35 years as well. And it is beautiful to be here. And all I have done this afternoon is wander around with my mouth open going, "Are you sure they're allowed to do this?" And so it's just a pleasure. And I just want to say thank you for all being here as well. It's been wonderful.
Well, should we leave it at that? Our moderator's left, so no one's going to chuck us out. But should we leave it at that?
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.